From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Attorney General Bill Barr said today that the Department of Justice has learned of serious irregularities at the federal facility where Jeffrey Epstein died, and that the department's inspector general will get to the bottom of what happened. What happened is that Epstein had been taken off suicide watch after trying to harm himself recently. He was supposed to be checked every half hour. He wasn't. He was supposed to have a cellmate. He didn't. Prison authorities say he hanged himself Saturday. So, of course, the criminal case against him by federal prosecutors has ended. But among the charges against Epstein was conspiracy to commit sex trafficking of minors, a charge that could be leveled against others. Barr also said that his co-conspirators should not rest easy. Let's bring in Nicole Hong. She covers courts and legal issues for The Wall Street Journal. Hi, Nicole.
Hi.
Now, we know that the day before Jeffrey Epstein took his life, a federal appeals court ordered disclosure of hundreds of pages of previously sealed documents, some sworn depositions, telling how Epstein recruited girls. This was part of a defamation suit filed by a woman against Epstein's companion, Ghislaine Maxwell. What's the legal significance of these documents?
So the documents were really the first time that we saw the full scope and scale of the alleged sex trafficking operation against him. There were depositions from former household employees. There were new details, new allegations, new names of men who had allegedly had sex with some of these women and girls. And more documents, we expect, will be unsealed in the coming weeks.
Yeah. Well, another woman, I believe the name is Johanna Joberg, testified in a deposition that she was recruited by Ghislaine Maxwell in 2001 as a college student. She was instructed in massages that included sexual acts. Many allegations. What is Maxwell saying?
Maxwell's lawyers have not commented to the press at all since Epstein's arrest. They have responded in civil lawsuits over the years, saying that, you know, she was never aware of any underage girls in the house. They've denied any of the allegations of sex abuse.
Well, you write that these new filings and criminal investigations threaten to ensnare Epstein's former high-profile clients, but we know that there were also personal connections to Bill Clinton, Prince Andrew. Bill Clinton's people said he took plane trips for his charity from Epstein, but they claim he severed any relationship. There are also scientists and academics. Epstein ingratiated himself with top scientists, many of them now saying they're embarrassed. They were willing to overlook what they could see, many underage women, because of what they might be getting from this relationship with what they thought was a wealthy man. Is not saying something, though, the same as conspiracy?
So, yeah, conspiracy, they have to prove that the person actually conspired with Epstein to carry out a sex trafficking operation. And so they're going to be targeting high-level people within his organization, the top recruiters, the top assistants, the top enablers, the people who helped procure these girls and, you know, taught them how to perform the massages. That's my guess of who prosecutors will be targeting next.
Well, there were also a number of subpoenas of these longtime associates who might be pilots, let's say, who were flying high-profile men to Epstein's private island. But what about NDAs? One detective working, you know, for some of these young victims said he met a man who worked for Epstein who sobbed because he wanted to talk, but he couldn't because of these non-disclosure agreements. Are they applicable now that Epstein is dead?
For the purposes of a federal criminal investigation, the non-disclosure agreement doesn't stop them from reporting criminal activity to federal prosecutors or from testifying before a grand jury. And since we know the criminal investigation is ongoing, I suspect a lot of people now will be wanting to talk to the government.
And President Trump, he was pictured partying with Epstein years ago. At the time, he said Epstein likes young girls. The president also said they had a falling out. We're told by Miami Herald reporter Julie Brown it was over a real estate deal. But there was that 2016 lawsuit alleging that Trump and Epstein assaulted an underage woman at a party. That was dismissed just before the 2016 election. What is any sense of President Trump's connection to any investigations?
So far, I think he's just one of the many high-profile men who have been in Jeffrey Epstein's orbit. Like I said before, federal prosecutors are going to be targeting, at least for criminal charges, people who were very high up in his organization, who worked for him directly, right. And who knew about the alleged criminal activity.
Right. Wall Street Journal's Nicole Hong, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, the Iowa State Fair is still going on, and in addition to being a mecca for food on a stick, it's seen as a key event for people running for president. NPR political correspondent Scott Detrow was just there and joins us now. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Jeremy.
Okay, so let's start with the piece of news that's making headlines today. The front runner for the Democrats, Joe Biden, misspoke a few times. Here he is mistakenly saying that he was vice president during the Parkland, Florida shooting in 2018.
I watched what happened when the kids from Parkland marched up to, and I met with them, and then they went off to up on the hill when I was vice president. They went off the hill to go into those neighborhoods. All those congressmen were like, no, I'm not here. I'm not here. Don't tell them I'm around.
Now, a Biden campaign spokeswoman tweeted about how Biden did meet with Parkland students in 2018, even though he wasn't vice president then. Scott, does this matter?
You know, I think the interesting thing is that in the beginning of the week, when Biden started this Iowa trip, he was probably the strongest I've seen him as a presidential candidate. He gave a very forceful speech denouncing President Trump, tying the president to white nationalist movements. And then he came to the fair and he was surrounded by media. He was surrounded by throngs, really clearly looked like the front runner in the race. But it wasn't just this. There were several other comments as well that he misspoke that seemed like the trademark Biden gaffes. And what they did is President Trump's campaign was very explicitly calling him out on this, saying that Biden is saying things that are wrong. And several other Democratic campaign staffers were kind of whispering and pointing this out to reporters as well. This is certainly a vulnerability for Biden. He's always had a reputation for misspeaking, but the fact is he's one of the oldest people ever to run for president, and this is a vulnerability.
But is he being held to a different standard right now than President Trump, who CNN reports that President Trump made 56 false claims just last week?
Sure. Yeah. And I think that's a very good counterpoint. And I think it's something that certainly Biden's campaign talks about a lot as well. And yeah, over and over again, the president will say things that are just simply not true or directly contradicted by videotape or many other things in a way that's far more egregious than any other politician that we can think of in recent memory. I think the question is how Biden compares to the rest of the field, many of whom have much shorter time in the spotlight than he has.
Well, you spoke with Kamala Harris, who's also in that kind of top five in the polls right now. You spent some time with her. How is she pitching herself?
Yeah, and that's a good way to put it. She has consistently been in the top tier of candidates in terms of polling and fundraising, but she has never really come close to taking the number one spot, to being the front runner, not a front runner. So what was interesting is this 5-day bus tour that she's on was really meant to show herself as a front runner, as someone who almost has the traveling presence and the crowd size and the overall approach of a nominee already. She's traveling the state in this enormous, sleek bus with her name painted on the side. It was a show of force almost. I talked to her about the fact that she is still behind Biden and Sanders and sometimes Warren in the polls. She feels very comfortable where she is right now. Her campaign points to the fact that she usually has very high favorability ratings with voters and caucus goers. And still a lot of voters don't know who she is compared to some of these other candidates. She feels like between now and the caucuses and a little less than 6 months, she has time to go from being a Democrat that a lot of people like to being the one they caucus for.
Now, what about Elizabeth Warren? She's been getting a lot of attention in Iowa. I was looking at your tweets over the weekend, and you said that she was getting up for almost every question that she was asked, like she wanted to show that she was ready to fight.
Yeah, she was going through the crowd just like radiating excitement and energy. She's one of these people who speaks to a crowd, even waves to a crowd, and gets everybody around her just happy and excited. And it was really notable to see the way that people would come out of their interactions with her. It was really hot at the time that Warren spoke at the fair on Saturday, but there were people who came specifically to hear Elizabeth Warren standing in the hot sun for an hour or more, making sure they could hear what she had to say. And, you know, that says something, especially when you need to organize supporters and get them to caucus at a certain place at a certain time. That much enthusiasm goes a long way.
The next round of Democratic debates is coming up in September. Who's qualified so far?
You know, the Elizabeth Warrens and the Kamala Harrises and the Joe Bidens of the world, they're not going to have any problem making the debate stage. They've already qualified. A lot of the candidates, though, you know, the Kirsten Gillibrands of the world, the Michael Bennets of the world, even people who have held statewide office, who have been on the national scene for a while, if you're not hitting 2% in the polls, you are not going to make the debate stage. Sounds like a low bar, but it's going to be tough for a lot of candidates to meet. I think as of right now, 7 or so of the 24 candidates have qualified for this debate stage.
And would they all be on the same stage if it's 10 or less?
A couple campaigns floated the idea of maybe like 11 people end up qualifying. And what does the DNC do at that point? I don't know the answer. You could divide it into two smaller nights or just put an extra lectern on the stage. We'll have
or
to
just
see.
10 one night and then one person debates themselves the next night.
As the person who has to stay up late two nights in a row for these things, I am all about one night if
one
possible.
Night. That's NPR political correspondent Scott Detrow. Scott, thank you.
Sure thing.
And we didn't talk about it, but Scott did have a corn dog on a stick wrapped in bacon at the state fair. The Grand Canyon is among the world's most amazing natural wonders, 277 miles long, up to 18 miles wide, and a mile deep. And 100 years ago this year, it became a national park, one of the most visited, with more than 6 million people visiting last year. All this week, we're going to be looking at the Grand Canyon National Park to mark its centennial, starting today with the geology, how this place was created by geologic events more than a billion years ago. Joining us now is Wayne Ranney, who's a geologist and author of Carving Grand Canyon, Evidence, Theories, and Mystery. Wayne, welcome.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. It's nice to be with you today.
And how can it be that this icon of America and the world, the Grand Canyon, which has been a national park for 100 years, still has so much mystery to it?
Well, the Grand Canyon is a large place, as I'm sure you can imagine. When people go to the South Rim or the North Rim where the hotels are located, and they look out, they're seeing only about one-tenth of the length of the Grand Canyon. So I would say that the main reason that it can't be completely understood is because of its immense size. Mm-hmm. But also, the Colorado River is constantly tearing away at the walls of the canyon and removing the evidence for its earliest history.
Okay, and the Colorado River is obviously a big part of why the Grand Canyon is the way that it is, but it's not where it all started. So take us back a couple of billion years ago and tell us how the layers of the canyon formed.
Well, the oldest rocks in the bottom of the Grand Canyon are almost 2 billion years old, and there's a pretty good record of sedimentation that follows after that. And if you count up the different layers of limestone, there's probably been 8 to 10 different seas that have inundated the Grand Canyon region over those 2 billion years. And there's a huge stack of sedimentary rocks that are brightly colored, gently uplifted, and then incised by this large river. And it just proves to be one of the best places on Earth to take in a sweeping view for the long span of geologic history.
So all of the Grand Canyon was underwater many times, is what you're saying.
That's correct. Sometimes people will say, I heard it, the ocean was here once, and I have to correct them slightly and say, no, it's been here many times, and the different layers represent that.
And what gives the rock its red color now?
In a general sense, when we look at red rocks, we're typically looking at sediments that were deposited on land, and the iron in that sediment reacted with the oxygen in the atmosphere and gave it these brilliant hues of reds and purples and golds. And so the sea was here all those many times, but also there's a long span of history where we had terrestrial environments, things like sand dunes and river floodplains and tidal flats. And the fossils that are preserved in these layers can help us understand this long span of Earth history.
Now, the Grand Canyon is part of the Colorado Plateau, which was lifted up. The south rim of the canyon is about 7,000 feet above sea level. The north rim is even higher, about 8,000 feet. What do we know about how the uplift happened?
Well, the uplift that is responsible for the Grand Canyon happened within the last 70 million years. So we can talk about those old rocks on the scale of hundreds of millions of years, but the uplift is the last 70 million years. And this uplift was due to the fact that the western part of North America, its crust was being squeezed from the west. And when it was squeezed horizontally, the rock layers got thick vertically. Mm-hmm. And that's what lifted up the plateau.
And I assume that the lift happened so slowly over time that you would never have been able to see it occur. It just happened over the course of, what, millions of years?
That's correct. I mean, you could live 10 lifetimes. You might have felt half a dozen earthquakes, but you wouldn't have noticed that you were being uplifted. But when you look through those tens of millions of years, then we can greatly uplift the Colorado Plateau.
Okay, and then we have the Colorado River, which carved the canyon. Tell us, when did that happen and how did that happen?
So one of the current ideas is that the initial cutting of the Grand Canyon was not necessarily done by the river we see today, but some of the segments that later became connected and then became the Colorado River.
So how long has the river or whatever eventually became the Colorado River been carving the canyon?
Well, we can go back to that 70 million year mark. And in that time, areas to the southwest of the Grand Canyon were uplifted into a huge mountain range, much like the Andes Mountains today. And prior ancestors to the Colorado River actually flowed in the opposite direction it goes today. Those rivers went from the mountains southwest of the Grand Canyon, and they went out onto the surface of what is now the Colorado Plateau.
What about wind and weather over the millennia?
Well, I think the wind is a very good agent to transport broken material out of the canyon. It's probably not a very big factor when it comes to actually breaking the rock apart. But once the other causes of weathering take effect, then the wind can carry that material away. And it's probably true that a lot of the material off of the Colorado Plateau is sitting out in the Rocky Mountains and the Great Plains of North America through all these millions of years.
Now, I assume that with all of this geology in the Grand Canyon, that there are a lot of fossils that can tell us more about what happened.
Yeah, the fossils are a very good indicator of the past environments. And even though the fossils are hundreds of millions of years old, they still give a record for what was here. And in these layers of rock in the Grand Canyon, there's evidence for giant Sahara-like deserts. And in those particular rocks, these sandstones that are cross-bedded, you can see well-preserved reptile tracks. And they let us know that this area was once very arid. The layer directly below that shows fern fossils, and it can tell us that the area was humid and there were rivers running through it. I mean, it's just things are changing through time, and that's what makes the Grand Canyon so special, is that all of these things are preserved and protected. Scientists are still going in there and digging up secrets from the walls of the Grand Canyon.
So what is still unknown or what's still up for debate about the geology of the Grand Canyon?
Oh, I think one of the biggest things that's in debate is the period of time when the rivers went opposite that the Colorado River goes today. There's about a 16 or 20 million year period where we lose sight of what the rivers were doing. So there's a period of time that begins about 30 million years ago, and then we finally get to see the river again somewhere between 6 and 16 million years ago, and it's going in the other direction. That's one of the things. There's three periods of uplift in the last 70 million years, and geologists are trying to figure out the relative importance or amount of uplift for each of those three periods. And one of the most exciting things that's happened recently is that it looks like the upwelling of hot mantle material in the western Grand Canyon is what has carved or helped to carve and deepen the western part of the Grand Canyon. And there's some lava flows that have poured over the rim of the canyon and are spectacularly preserved and plastered on the walls out there in the western Grand Canyon.
So as a geologist, is there any place on Earth that's more interesting to you than the Grand Canyon?
Well, Jeremy, I've been fortunate enough to travel to 90 countries studying geology, and I keep looking for a place that approximates the Colorado Plateau. And I guess I'm happy to say that there is no place. The Colorado Plateau is very unique. But a couple of places that come to mind are Northwest Argentina on the east side of the Andes. Some of the eastern parts of Morocco next to the Atlas Mountains also have similar characteristics to the Colorado Plateau. But here, the Colorado Plateau, 130,000 square miles, there's really no place on Earth that even approximates what we have right here in the southwestern part of the United States.
Do you think that in 70 million years, if the Earth is still around, that the Grand Canyon will be significantly different than it is today?
Without a doubt. I mean, if we went back 70 million years ago, the Grand Canyon region had just been exposed from under an inland sea. It was very close to sea level. The weather was completely tropical at that time. You'd have no idea that a future Grand Canyon was going to form there.
Do you think of the Grand Canyon as an American thing or
Absolutely.
Just a world thing?
Absolutely. Well, it's an American thing. I think if there were one landscape that people associate with America, it would be the Grand mm-hmm. Canyon. But 40% of the visitors here come from other countries, and that percentage is increasing. And so on the one hand, it is strictly an American icon, but on the other hand, it's a world icon.
What's your favorite thing about it?
My favorite thing about it is how it's constantly changing with respect to the weather and the climate and the time of day and the time of year. It's such a big place. The temperature difference from the top to the bottom can be 30 or 35 degrees Fahrenheit. The temperature differences between winter and summer can be up to 70 or 100 degrees. If you had an imaginary highway along the Colorado River and you drove along that highway at 70 miles an hour, it would still take you 4 hours to drive through the Grand Canyon. So as the river trip or your trip down the river unfolds, you're constantly seeing new and different landscapes. Even though the rock layers remain the same, they are exposed beneath three different North American deserts in that whole trip.
That's Wayne Ranney, who is a geologist and author of the book Carving Grand Canyon, Evidence, Theories, and Mystery. Wayne, great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy, and thank you for loving the Grand Canyon.
And we will continue our series tomorrow talking about the Havasupai tribe that's been living at the Grand Canyon for many centuries. That's tomorrow on Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat. Ever wish feeling too hot or too cold were optional? As summer heats up outside, just press for a thermal wave designed to provide cooling relief. Over air-conditioned inside? Leave that sweater in the car and rely on Emberwave instead. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave, control your comfort.
The Hong Kong airport is still closed. Authorities there closed it earlier today after 4 days of protests, thousands of people staging sit-ins in the departure and arrivals halls, chanting, "Democracy is a good thing." Nearly 200 incoming and outgoing flights have been canceled. And now Hong Kong's flagship airline, Cathay Pacific, is warning its employees that they could be fired if they support or participate in illegal protests. Let's bring in Here Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Seth, we were seeing pictures of bewildered travelers, you know, with their roller bags, stopping to talk to the protesters as they got off planes in Hong Kong. It was a mess.
Yeah, and keep in mind, Robin, that this is one of the world's busiest airports and a very busy connecting airport, the 12th busiest airport in the world based on the number of seats scheduled at Hong Kong today. More than 500 departing flights, another 500 arriving flights. So with everything going on in Hong Kong, surely there are people who have canceled their travel to Hong Kong as a destination here in recent weeks. But those aren't the only people who fly to that airport. Somebody living in Seattle on their way to Bangkok would connect in a place like Hong Kong. And so all kinds of impact here on the global aviation system with flights canceled. And Cathay as an airline has generally seemed to stay kind of above the political fray. You know, I don't think people, when they book tickets on Cathay Pacific, are thinking generally in political terms. But now the airline, very much in the middle of what's going on in Hong Kong because of this stance that it's taken, as you said, threatening to fire employees. And in fact, the airline's shares closed Monday at a decade-long low. Yeah. So that tells you pressure, not just because of just what's going on operationally, lost business, but perhaps now people thinking also in those terms about you know, whether they want to support an airline that's taking the position that it's taking.
Right. Well, this started as a protest over a proposed extradition bill. People in Hong Kong could be extradited to mainland China. But now it feels like a full-throated protest of, you know, China's rule over Hong Kong. We know that Hong Kong, the handover, Hong Kong was handed over back to China after a long time British rule. All flights now canceled until tomorrow. As you said, this is one of the busiest airports in the world. Cathay Pacific answers to China's Civil Aviation Administration, and they have announced that they would ban Cathay employees who take part in any kind of illegal demonstrations. And the agency also said it would require the airline to submit identification details about all relevant crews for approval prior to takeoff.
Right. So it started off as a ban on travel to mainland China for employees that had taken part in protest. And then it escalated, you know, rather than sort of backing off. Then it became the airline saying that yeah, they could actually be fired. Mm-hmm. So that's where, you know, this is different from the position that airlines would take in many parts of the world. A U.S. or a European airline, typically, you know, employees can do whatever they want politically as long as it's legal in their own time. But Cathay has said that even what these employees are doing in their own time, you know, reflects badly on the airline, and that they could, in fact, lose their jobs over taking part in the protests.
Well, as you said, it's an escalating situation, so we will keep an eye as it escalates. Seth Kaplan, Here Now's transportation analyst. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Koch Foods, not related to the conservative Koch brothers' business empire, but a poultry processing plant in Morton, Mississippi, is hosting a job fair today after the largest immigration raid in nearly a decade resulted in hundreds of its workers being detained, many deported. Will they find the workers they need? It's illegal to hire undocumented workers in the U.S., but the poultry industry has been actively recruiting them for years, according to our next guest. Angela Stisi is a cultural anthropologist at UNC Chapel Hill, author of the book Scratching Out a Living, Latinos, Race, and Work in the Deep South. She joins us now, Professor Stisi. Angela, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And I want to start with an anecdote you tell in a very scholarly piece you wrote with Laura Helton. This was in 2013. But as part of your research back then, you were interviewing a worker who had been selling oranges in Florida when he was walking along the road and a van pulled up to him. What did this worker say happened?
Well, he was one of several people that I talked to about that era of sort of how folks got to rural Mississippi. And he and others said that they found advertisements in the local Cuban store or in the local paper. They were working in the orange groves, mostly picking oranges in Florida. And the prospect of indoor work was promising. And so folks who saw this ad, at least those who ended up in Mississippi, responded to it and were recruited by the industry and transported by the poultry, by a particular local poultry plant, to Mississippi, and in some cases started work the very night that they arrived.
Yeah. We'll get more to what that has meant in present-day Mississippi, but let's go back first. When there are these huge raids, we are usually reminded this situation was very different years ago. You write, poultry workers in Mississippi were at one time white women.
That's right. So the poultry industry in the South and in central Mississippi in particular got started in the 1930s and really ramped up transformed from sort of a backyard endeavor in which people were raising chickens for consumption and selling what they could into a factory setting during World War II and following World War II. And it was generally working class white women who staffed those lines.
Because as one of those women told you, up until something like the 1960s, most Mississippi chicken plants would not hire African Americans.
That's right. That's right. And it was actually part of the civil rights movement, following gains in voting rights and civil rights, folks' attention shifted to economic rights and African American folks who were still largely working on sharecropping on land in the area were pushing for the prospect of better work, and chicken processing represented that opportunity to them.
Well, even though it's considered one of the worst jobs in America.
This is true.
Yeah. Well, but there was another factor that you write about that was fascinating, something called the Balance Agriculture with Industry Plan, in which they subsidized factory-based industries to get them to come into the state. And this really hurt the African-Americans because they couldn't be hired in those more upscale factories. So they were almost driven to the chicken factories.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And that's part of the historical research that Laura Helton and I did, was sort of unearthing the archives that showed that the Balance Agriculture with Industry Plan both pumped a lot of money into the local efforts to attract industry to the state of Mississippi. But yes, many of those were closed to African American workers. And it wasn't until the 60s, in some cases, even the early 70s, that Black workers gained access to the chicken plants.
And then what happened? I mean, we just heard one anecdote about employers recruiting workers in Florida, but how did it shift to a largely Hispanic worker base?
Well, I think before that shift, it's maybe important to note that within weeks of beginning to hire Black workers, almost all the white women workers left the chicken plants. And so there was a dramatic shift in the late 60s and early 70s from a workforce of white women to a workforce of Black women and men. And that continued through the 70s, 80s, and early 90s. And those workers gradually, you know, were trying to organize for better wages and working conditions. The industry was also expanding. Americans were eating a lot more chicken, sort of heart-healthy diet. So the plants went from one shift a day to two shifts a day, and then to three shifts, running 24 hours a day. And they were looking, so they were expanding and needing more workers. They were initially recruiting from nearby counties and even as far away as Alabama. And when this wasn't enough, and when workers succeeded in establishing unions and the chicken plants were faced with negotiating with those workers, the idea of looking further afield to South Florida emerged as a solution to that problem.
Well, so you have in the mid-90s, whole southern communities being changed, over 500,000 Hispanics moving to the South in that decade, 500,000 in one decade, fastest growing Latino population in the country at the turn of the millennium, you know, 2000. It grew by 1,000% in the 1990s in Mississippi. It's now, as you say, some are calling it Nuevo South, the New South. When you spoke to all these workers, what's your sense? Because you spoke to African-American workers as well. We saw in the pictures of the raids, there are still African-American workers, you know, holding on to and sobbing with their Hispanic colleagues as people were taken away from these plants. What's the sense in these communities of these workers?
You know, I think early on, folks thought that immigrants were transient and were going to come and go, and that it was sort of a temporary thing. And 25 years in, they're very much a part of the social fabric of communities and of workplaces. And you're right, they're working right alongside a longstanding and disenfranchised African-American workforce. And a lot of the work over the last few decades has been to try to help folks build bridges across differences of race and cultural background to be able to organize for better wages and working conditions in the plants.
Yeah. Well, and there's a pattern of some of the first African Americans to integrate a company, Southeastern Poultry, that you write about. They told you that whites who were trying to unionize or organize for better working conditions, they had a walkout, and that's when the Blacks were called in. The African Americans then pushed during the civil rights era for better working conditions, and that's when the Hispanics come in. Who comes in now?
That's an excellent question. I think we can demonize the industry or the employers for seeking out a more flexible and more exploitable class of workers. But I also think employers are held accountable to their shareholders and are required, you know, by law to do their best to produce profit for shareholders. And I think as long as the advanced capitalist economy holds corporations accountable to owners and shareholders instead of to the folks who work for them or the communities in which they live, we're going to see them constantly in this race to the bottom. I am trying to encourage folks to think beyond, you know, is it the employers or the workers who are causing this problem, and recognize that, in fact, our entire economic system is pushing the employment of undocumented people. And, you know, structures of global inequality are pushing folks to migrate. Mm. In other parts of the South, I have heard of poultry plants starting to recruit refugees from the Marshall Islands, from other parts of the world. And in a couple of cases, I have read, although I haven't seen myself, that chicken plants are relying on incarcerated labor, which is sort of the epitome of an unfree workforce, right? And sort of brings us back to the unfree labor of the South prior to the Civil War in some ways.
Huh. Angela Cici, cultural anthropologist at UNC Chapel Hill, author of the book Scratching Out a Living, Latinos, Race, and Work in the Deep South, and other scholarly tracts on the workforce in the South. Professor Cici, Angela, thank you so much.
Thank you for making space for these ideas. Important stories to tell.
Thanks. Well, back to Mississippi and that raid on chicken processing plants there. Over 680 workers arrested, many deported. So far, there have been no charges against the five companies which own the seven plants raided, although federal investigators say that could change as an investigation is ongoing. And according to WREG-TV in Memphis, unsealed court documents reveal that six of the seven plants not only employed people who lacked authorization to work in the U.S., some workers were wearing monitoring bracelets at work because of previous immigration violations. That's how federal investigators found them. Employers have largely avoided criminal charges because it's hard to prove they knew workers were illegal. Those bracelets may show employers knew. At the Coke Foods job fair today, applicants are being asked to bring two forms of ID.
An investigation is underway in Erie, Pennsylvania, into the tragic fire at an overnight daycare center that killed five young children yesterday. The victims ranged in ages from just 8 months old to 7 years old. The owner is in the hospital. More than half of the children under five in this country are in some kind of daycare. And of course, it's one place where parents have to trust that their kids will be safe. The cost of that trust is high. On average, childcare can cost more than $1,200 a month. And in parts of the state of Maine, just getting a spot in a center can also be a challenge. Jennifer Mitchell from Maine Public Radio reports.
I can't remember their name, but one couple was late.
Yes.
And they were even working on...
In this prenatal class in Portland, women and their partners are here to learn more about the birthing process they'll soon experience.
When your water breaks, what leaks out is the amniotic fluid surrounding the baby's head. But behind the shoulders...
The couples seem pretty clear on some of the choices they must make, such as delivery positions, hospital birth or home birth, doctor or midwife. But for many, there's one issue that's still unsettled.
Thinking about the cost of childcare is something that's pretty scary for us. It is a huge expense, and it will be a huge part of our budget, and we'll have to make cuts in other places.
Emily and partner Ryan are currently on five childcare waiting lists. They have 5 weeks to go before their baby arrives, and both eventually plan to return to work while their child is still an infant. According to their research, full-time care in their area costs in excess of $1,000 per month. Emily is still paying off student loans, and the couple bought a home just a year ago. They say they'll likely need to maintain both incomes.
I'd be bummed if I had to give up my job. You know, there's a lot of expenses that come along with a kid, and I definitely could use the income.
We would just have to figure it out. I'm not sure what we would do.
2 hours up the road in Bangor, Abby Strout Bench has already been through the uncertainty of trying to get her son into daycare. She's one of the lucky ones, though. A spot finally became available in March for her son Oscar, who's almost a year old now.
It was really stressful. I think I didn't realize how stressful it was until we got the call, and I literally felt lighter. Even like thinking back to it makes me want to cry because it was such a relief.
Strout Bench says she and her husband started looking for childcare openings while she was a few months pregnant, which she thought would be more than enough lead time.
A lot of places would say to us, you know, many women call as soon as they're pregnant, and it sort of felt like we're failing as parents because we didn't call right away. I mean, I don't really believe that, but it felt a little bit like shaming that we weren't already on lists.
While she's relieved to have found a spot, Strout Bench says she and her husband have had to raid their savings and put their dreams of home ownership on a back burner, and other sacrifices might be required.
We could not, even with two incomes, we could not afford to have two kids in daycare at the same time. So planning how many years to have the kids apart or whether or not we have a second child.
So why is childcare so costly? Some experts say that part of it may have something to do with changing expectations across the generations. Parents today demand that their daycare centers provide more than just a graham cracker and a nap.
With that quality and with that higher expectation, there is a cost to that.
Jane Purdy, who owns and operates Little Friends Early Learning Center in Freeport, says it's good that parents are demanding quality childhood education and development for their pre-K kids. But to deliver that, she says she also needs to find quality teachers and assistants and pay them well enough to stick around. And then there are state safety standards and regulations governing drinking water quality, among other cost drivers.
You know, fire marshals, state expectations, those prices are going up. Insurance, workman's comp, and especially most directly going up is the payroll.
I think that if we don't begin to look at this problem from a societal and economic standpoint, that it's going to be to the detriment of everyone.
Susan Gardner is director of Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at the University of Maine. She personally experienced the difficulty of finding childcare for her adopted daughter almost 5 years ago. But Gardner says the childcare problem for working women isn't actually new, and it's time to destroy the illusion that it is.
To be clear, even when we had more stay-at-home moms, those were often more white, affluent mothers who were staying home. There's always been a need for a lot of other mothers to work.
While today more fathers might be open to staying home with the kids, economic pressures often dictate that both parents have to work. Gardner says, for the most part, solving the childcare puzzle has been left up to the families. And that, she says, really has to change.
Maine is really interesting in this way because we are a state that we know our younger population is declining. We are the oldest state in the United States. And if we want to continue to bring in and maintain younger people in this area and bring in businesses, we have to address this systematically and systemically.
The big question is, how? For Here and Now, I'm Jennifer Mitchell in Portland, Maine.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.